Internationally known for his work on environmental issues, Fred Singer, Ph.D., also pioneered rocket and satellite technology. His presentation is titled, Basis of Climate Scare Demolished, But Hype Marches On.
This afternoon, I'd like to divide my presentation into three parts. I tend to divide my presentations into three parts. This has a historical reason, I think. When I was a boy, I was forced to study Latin, and I hated it. I got as far as the Gallic Wars by Julius Caesar, and all I remember is that his opus starts off with saying that Gaul is divided into three parts. So that's all. Gallia, omnia Gallia est divisa in partes tres. I had to memorize it because I misbehaved, and punishment was to memorize the first page of his book. Anyway, I will first of all try to bring you up to date on the status of the global warming debate, particularly scientific issues. They keep changing all the time, and I expect by next year we'll have a different update than we do today. But that's the way science is. It moves ahead. The second part of my presentation is technical. And I apologize for that. But those of you who are not interested can sort of doze off and or leave. But I urge you to stay. Because the third part of my presentation will deal with some of the current politics, the G8 meeting in Scotland, and things that have come out of that, and end up with the discussion of what the U.S. Senate is up to recently, which may be of some interest to you. So let me start by doing the presentation on the current status of global warming, and this will be a critique of the latest IPCC report, which is the third assessment, which is the one that concluded that they have new evidence, strong evidence, for human effects on global warming. I'll try to show you that their evidence is unrealistic, spurious, and doesn't amount to anything. The reason why my issue is important is because our energy policy, which is important, very, very important, is influenced by three major threats that people have, and unfortunately, that also exist in the U.S. Congress. The first threat is that CO2 increases causes climate disasters. And that, of course, is the theme of my presentation. But I do want to mention the second one particularly, that low-level radiation causes cancer is another myth that influences our energy policy very strongly. And you'll be hearing more about this from Jim Muckahide. So I will not discuss it any further. The third issue we won't be able to touch on today is that there's a problem of oil security, supply interruptions, and so on. And this also dictates strange policies, strange energy policies, all of which have the effect of raising the cost of energy to the consumer, to the American economy, and slowing down economic growth. And that is serious. So while I do not consider global warming to be a serious issue, it's an interesting issue, but it's not serious. Energy policy is serious, and it's important that these three fears that I've just mentioned here, and there are others, of course, but these are the major ones in my view, that these be understood and met and explained, particularly to decision makers, so that we will not end up with counterproductive policies that hurt the economy, hurt the consumer, and particularly people in low-income groups. Okay, there are certain things that everyone agrees on, and that is that there are certain gases called greenhouse gases. Technically speaking, these are gases that absorb radiation in the infrared. You notice that we do not include oxygen and nitrogen, the major gases of the atmosphere. Those are not greenhouse gases. They are diatomic. All these greenhouse gases have more than two atoms. These are molecules with more than two atoms, so they can have various kinds of modes of vibration and stretching and rotation, which tend to absorb infrared energy. We also agree that these gases have been increasing in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, and this is a result of human activity. And then going further, it is generally agreed that the effect of this increase in greenhouse gases should be an increase in temperature, in global temperature, a warming. The theory, and how we begin to have differences, calculates certain increases based on a very crude and rather simple, naive model of the Earth's atmosphere. The observations do not show this. So the basic disagreement in the scientific community, if you want to be very rough about it, is there's one group that believes in models, in theoretical models, and therefore claims that there's something wrong with the observations, and the other group, to which I belong and many of my colleagues, that believes that the models are inadequate. And one reason why we're very strong in this belief is because the models disagree among themselves. There's some two dozen major models in the world today. We in the United States are blessed with at least three that I know about, three major models. This is an indication of the fact that we have a lot of money to spend because our government likes to support these activities. These models are expensive to operate, but we have three of them. Other major industrialized countries have usually one. They're more modest. The British model is quite well known, the Canadian model, there's one in Germany, and those are the major ones in the world today. And then there are quite a few more that I would not count as major ones. The point about all these models is that they all try to calculate the future warming based on the greenhouse effect, and that they disagree among themselves by about 400%. So the question then is, which model should we believe? Or any of them? My inclination is not to believe any of them because they do not agree, any of them, with the observations. And really the only way you can validate a model to judge whether it is correct or not is to compare it to observations, to validate it. You have to hindcast, so to speak, against observations which extend back, good observations really only extend back 25 years, to be honest. We have surface temperature records, so-called global ones that extend back over 100 years, and then we have, of course, geologic records that you heard about this morning from Sally Balunas that extend back into millions of years, but the models do not try to cover those. They're mainly interested in explaining what's happened since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. The IPCC report, I don't know if you've ever seen it or not, is a very thick volume, about 800 pages, containing a reasonably good survey of published work in the field of climate science. It's no help at all, because unless you actually are familiar with the volume, and I am because I served as one of the reviewers, You can't find out anything about anything because it has no index. It does have what's called a summary, what is called a summary. It's called a summary for policymakers. And my challenge to you is to tell me, what do you think journalists read, or what do you think politicians will read when they get their volume? And those of you who raise their hand and say, the summary, you're wrong. They read not the five-page summary, they read the one-page press release based on the summary. That's what they read. And that's what gets quoted. And the summary, which is very selective, and only picks out from the report those data, those facts that support its conclusion, and it puts those in the press release. By that time, of course, the scientists who work on the report have nothing to say about any of this. They're innocent. They have been used, so to speak. But the press release then says that there's now new and stronger evidence that most of the warming in the last 50 years is attributable to human activities. Let me tell you that this is not true. In fact, we're not even sure that there has been a warming in the last 50 years. There was a warming in the early part of the 20th century, up to about 1940. But everyone, almost everyone, agrees that that was not due to human activities. It was the recovery from what you heard about this morning, a recovery from the Little Ice Age. After the Little Ice Age had lasted for a few hundred years, the climate got tired of the cold and decided to warm up. Most of us think that was due to a change in solar radiation, solar activity. Had nothing to do with human activities, had nothing to do with a rise in greenhouse gases. In fact, after 1940, when greenhouse gas concentrations really increased, shot up because of use of cars everywhere and industrial activity after World War II, the climate cooled. You saw an example of that this morning when headlines proclaimed a coming ice age. Some of you in this audience may remember this. You have to be at least 50 or more, to remember that around 1970, there was widespread fear that we're entering a new ice age. Those were the headlines that shouted, ice age is coming. Books were being written about the coming ice age. People were imploring the government to do something about it, as if the government could do anything about an ice age. You know, this morning when I listened to Sally, I felt that really we should have a movement to stop continental drift. It's the same kind of business. You cannot stop a coming ice age. Although, there is a school of thought, a small school of thought, that thinks that by releasing enough greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we might stave off the commencement of an ice age. That's a debatable point. It would be an interesting beneficial feature of global warming if that were true. But we don't know if it's true. So let's look at the evidence, and that's what I'm going to be spending my time on, the evidence that was produced by the IPCC, the three major pieces of evidence, and I'll quickly tell you what's wrong with them, and then we'll go on. Here they are. The first piece claims that the 20th century is the warmest in the last 1,000 years. This produced a curve, a graph, which is generally referred to as a hockey stick because it shows a steady decline in temperature over the last 1,000 years until about 1900, and then suddenly the temperature shoots up. The second piece of evidence, so-called evidence, is that the temperature has increased drastically in the 20th century, and half of that increase was in the last decades, which are now the warmest. This is, of course, partly true. It's partly true because, as I mentioned earlier, there was an increase up till 1940, but that was not caused by greenhouse warming, nor does the IPCC claim this. So they're confusing the reader here. This is what we call, in the magic business, distracting the reader. You tell him something that's partly true to keep him from guessing the whole truth. The third thing they try to do is to see if they can account for the actual temperature history of the 20th century by a combination of natural factors and human factors. And I'll talk more about this, because this is primarily an exercise in curve fitting. They have enough adjustable parameters in this exercise to fit not just the 20th century curve, but any curve you wish. You know, if you have enough adjustable parameters, as John von Neumann says, give me enough adjustable parameters and I can fit an elephant. If you give me one more, I can make his trunk wiggle. This actual quote. John von Neumann was, of course, a famous mathematician. Okay, we have. I'll go over this more rapidly because this has already been discussed this morning. And in fact, most of the contributions to this effort have come from Sally and Halbernius and Willie Soon, who were able to demonstrate exhaustively that the actual empirical evidence does not show a steady decline in temperature, as this hockey stick curve suggests. You see here, I'm learning how to use this. 1,000 years ago, they saw a steady decline. This is what they tend to show. And then this sudden rise. This curve has been thoroughly discredited, primarily also through the efforts of two Canadian researchers, whose names may be familiar to you by now, McIntyre and McKittrick. We call them M&M, like the famous candy. And so M&M have shown that in constructing this curve, the authors, primarily Michael Mann from my university, the University of Virginia, I have to admit this, actually mishandled the data, underlying data, and furthermore, used a faulty methodology. In fact, M&M were able to show that if you put in random data into his methodology, you'll always get a hockey stick. By now, the most leading scientists who work in this field, even those who support the idea of global warming, have concluded that the hockey stick is dead or broken. But being disingenuous about it, they say, well, we didn't need it in the first place. This, of course, is not what the IPCC claimed in its report. It made a big deal about the hockey stick, but now that it's been proven to be spurious, faulty, no good, I'm running out of adjectives, the proponents of global warming claim, well, we didn't need it. In addition to this, as you heard this morning again, temperatures were warmer 1,000 years ago than they are today, and much, much warmer than they are today about 5,000 years ago. So there's nothing special about the 20th century. And the warming that we've seen in the 20th century cannot be taken as proof of any human influence. In fact, there is, as I indicated just a moment ago, a good deal of doubt whether the climate is currently warming, let's say in the last 25 years. The point there is that one set of data, namely the surface data taken at weather stations around the world, do show a warming trend. And that's what is widely quoted. But the best data we have in the last 25 years comes from weather satellites and also from weather balloons that measure temperatures in radio sounds as they go up through the atmosphere. And these two sets of data, satellites and weather balloons, do not show any appreciable warming. They show some warming, but not nearly as much warming as the surface data. And that's very odd, very strange, because according to the theory, the greenhouse theory, the atmosphere must warm more strongly than the surface. That's the essence of the greenhouse effect. In fact, our National Academy of Sciences set up a panel to look into this, to try to reconcile the atmospheric data from weather satellites and balloons with the surface data. Why do they disagree? They published a report, very excellent report, in which they concluded they couldn't see anything wrong with any of the data, but they couldn't reconcile the difference. People are still concerned about this problem today. It has not been settled to everyone's satisfaction. So we have a major disagreement also among the data. So this disparity presents a problem. As you see, that my colleague Douglas, Dave Douglas, and I have worked on this. And I'll try to show you a result which has just been published, because while it doesn't settle the problem, it does indicate that there must be something wrong with the surface data that show a warming. And that's why we strongly believe that the current warming is insignificant and certainly not in accord with what the climate models would predict. In other words, it disproves both the surface data and the validity of the current models that are used to predict the future. This shows a comparison between surface data. These are temperature trends. These are the, there we go, surface data here, plotted from South Pole to North Pole, and these are the satellite data. And you can clearly see that the satellite data show much less of a trend. In fact, they show negative trends in the equatorial region. So the major difference exists in the equatorial region, which are mostly ocean. I'm going to come to that later. Please file this away in your mind, that there's something wrong with the sea surface temperature measurements, which of course give you, they seem to be showing a positive trend, whereas the satellite data do not show a positive trend. There's a lot wrong with the surface data. One of them is that they are affected and contaminated by something called the urban heat island effect. You're all familiar with that, of course. You know that urban areas are warmer than the countryside. You all know that temperatures are higher in the center of a city than they are in the suburbs. You all know that those of you who come from areas where it snows, some of you do here, know that the snow melts in the center of the city. In fact, it doesn't even stick, while it piles up in the suburbs and the countryside. Cities are warmer because that's where people live. People generate lots of energy. In fact, your metabolism generates about 100 watts. So this room, for example, is warmer because of all of you here. Thank you very much. And, by the way, also, let me tell you, in case you are worried about this, that the carbon dioxide level in this room is about between 2 and 3 times what it is outdoors. Any of you feel any ill effects? No, good. There are none. Carbon dioxide is not toxic. It cannot be detected. Probably good for you in many ways. Well, let's look at the urban heat island effect. Most of the best weather stations that we have are located at airports. There's a reason for this, because that's where we need good weather data, at airports. So what we can say is, yes, airports are warming, but not. We cannot say this about the globe as a whole. We have California weather stations. California, I know, is a very rich state. They can afford to have lots of stations. So they have done over 100 stations in California, some where there are practically no people, and some in the Los Angeles areas where there are a lot of people. And look at this. You see that the stations that are located in areas with more than a million people show a very strong increase in temperature over the last 100 years. Stations that are located in counties that have less than 100,000 people show practically no increase. This is a very, very graphic demonstration of the urban heat island effect. Incidentally, you will see here in the data this warming that took place up to about 1940. You see it? Then a cooling after that, and then really nothing after this. Fluctuations, but no significant trend. Okay, we now come to the third item, where they try to show that the global mean temperature of the 20th century can be explained by combination, by models, into which they stick natural forcings, that is from solar variability and volcanoes, and from anthropogenic forcings, that would be greenhouse gases released by human activities, mainly energy generation, and aerosols created as you produce energy, mainly sulfate aerosols from sulfur put into the atmosphere from burning coal. Well, this is what they do. They show that if you just use natural forcings, you can only explain the rise in temperature up to 1940, but you cannot explain what they consider to be the recent rise in the last 25 years, which they assume to be real. If you just use anthropogenic forcings, you can't explain the decline in temperature between 1940 and 1975. But lo and behold, if they use both natural and anthropogenic forcing, they can explain the temperature history of the 20th century. What does this show? Well, it shows, first of all, that they cannot explain the decrease in temperature between 1940 and 75 unless they use natural forcing. This means that natural forcings are much larger and much more important than any forcing from anthropogenic activities, human activities, at least at this stage. The other thing it shows is they still believe in this recent warming, and there are reasons to doubt this because it does not appear in the satellite and balloon data. So this is an exercise in curve fitting. They've adjusted, there were a number of parameters here that you could adjust. They have adjusted the parameters, and lo and behold, the things fit. The only problem is they fit the global mean. Those of you who work in statistics know that means are always easy to fit. The question is, can they fit the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere separately? The answer is no. This reminds me of the story of the statistician who had one foot in a bucket of boiling water and another foot in a bucket of ice water. And in the mean and the average, he was very, very comfortable. It's kind of a problem. Also, they've left out important forcings. And that's a very interesting logical point. You don't have to be a climate scientist or a rocket scientist to realize that if you can fit the record, the observed record, as they've tried to do here, and leave out important forcings, then if you stick in these important forcings that they haven't used, the chances of fitting are minute, or zero. So they've essentially disproven their own assertion. So we try to demonstrate here that this new and strong evidence is all bunk. We don't argue that the greenhouse effect doesn't work. We simply say that it's a lot smaller than the models predict. It's really too small to be detectable. And it may only amount, by the end of the century, to maybe half a degree or a little more of warming, which would be detectable, but of course is insignificant. In other words, global warming, in our view, is a minor issue. Aside from that, it's probably true, as economists have deduced, that global warming is good for you. On the whole, not for everyone, but on the whole, people benefit from a warmer climate, which is probably why people move to warmer places. Maybe ski operators will lose some money. On the other hand, beach resorts will gain. It's always like this. When the weather changes or the climate changes, some gain, some lose. But on the whole, the net is a gain to the economy of the United States. This has been published in a very learned book, a very learned analysis. You may wish to look it up. I have it referenced on my website. It's by a leading Yale resource economist, Professor Mendelson, and two dozen of his colleagues have worked on this. So it represents, I think, a substantial fraction of the resource economists, the real experts in this field. I will now move more rapidly to a recent result that Dave Douglas and I have published. This is somewhat technical, so I apologize for that. The question is, if there is a warming, how can you tell whether it's natural or whether it's caused by humans? After all, the climate is always warming or cooling. So there are always times when the climate is warming. How can you tell whether it's caused by human activities? Good question. Well, the answer is that the greenhouse theory makes certain predictions. The warming has to fulfill certain conditions. These are called fingerprints. So we look for fingerprints. And the important fingerprint is, how does the warming depend on altitude in the atmosphere? And the models, let me give you one example here. Let me take this one here. The tropics. These are the models. All predict that the warming trend should increase with altitude. This is the warming trend. This is altitude plotted here. So the warming trend should increase with altitude. What do the data show? And these are several sets of data from balloons and other sources. First of all, they show that the trends are much less even. And furthermore, they show that the trend decreases with altitude. So the fingerprint method would indicate that even if there is a warming, it is not caused by human activities. At least it is not in accord with the greenhouse theory. Okay, back on track again after this little excursion. The question of consensus always comes up. Let me skip this Kyoto Protocol. The consensus comes up. I've listed here a number of statements and declarations over the years by people of some substance and knowledge who've expressed great doubt about the existence of a substantial global warming due to anthropogenic effects, starting with a poll that our organization took of leaders of the American Meteorological Society. It was published. We have the International Heidelberg Appeal, which is international. We have also a statement of atmospheric scientists. Oops. We have the Leipzig Declaration, which is international, which is climate specialists. We've issued it twice now. We'll do it again. The American Association of Petroleum Geologists. We have, very important here, the Oregon petition against Kyoto. which was signed by nearly 20,000 scientists. This was done through the initiative of Art Robinson. This is why I call it the Oregon Petition. Seems like a good word for it. We have the formal statement of the American Association of State Climatologists expressing great doubt about the veracity of anthropogenic global warming. We have a report just published by the Russian Academy of Sciences. And finally, thanks to a German organization, we have a poll of 500 climate specialists also showing a large fraction of these, about 25%, expressing skepticism. On the other hand, we have we have also international responses. You can read this. This is the German poll which I spoke about. Incidentally, it did not include me, so I can speak about it very dispassionately. We have the Russian Academy's statement, and we have President Putin, who has termed Kyoto scientifically flawed. And even Tony Blair, who seems to be promoting action against global warming, has just recently, that is this year, stated, so it would seem to be true that the evidence is still disputed. So he recognizes that there is no consensus. This is very, very strange because his own science advisor has been in the forefront of promoting global warming. It's really very funny. This science advisor is Sir David King, and he's made a name for himself by his outrageous statements. Look at these, for example. The second one. The first statement is by the man who was in charge of looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Hans Blix, what an idiot. I'm glad he was no longer in charge. The second one is by Sir David King. Global warming is a greater threat than terrorism. I haven't spoken to him in the last week. He may have changed his mind by now. But look at his next statement. Antarctica is likely to be the world's only habitable continent by the end of the century. I recommend that he buy real estate there. Well, then, of course, we have Tim Wirth and Al Gore, who actually sound moderate in comparison to some of these characters. I want to show you a final thing, a scientific graph again, which seems to indicate that climate changes are mainly controlled by the sun and not by carbon dioxide. It's a remarkable set of data published in the last few years. There have now been other data published that support this. We try to use proxies. We don't know what the sun was doing 4,000 years ago, but we can check on carbon-14 as a proxy for solar changes. And we have oxygen-18, which is a proxy for climate changes. See, we didn't have thermometers a few thousand years ago, so we have to use proxies. So geologists really know how to do this very well, and here is the result. Look at this record from a stalagmite in a cave in Oman, in Arabia, covering about 4,000 years, and you see this excellent correlation between carbon-14, indicating the sun, and oxygen-18, indicating temperatures. And here is the central 400 years blown up. You can see the correspondence is almost one-to-one. Now, this is the end of this discussion. And I'd like to turn to the next topic, which is scientific. And I would say if you wish to skip over it, just close your eyes. But the issue here is the following. I've indicated to you that there's something wrong with the sea surface temperatures in the tropics. And the question is, what could be wrong with these measurements? First of all, you have to understand that the greenhouse effect consists of infrared radiation emitted from these radiative gases like carbon dioxide coming down to the Earth, adding to the solar radiation, which is in the visible. So you have the sun's radiation penetrating into the ocean, heating the surface of the ocean, and then you have infrared radiation. The problem is, here's a sketch, this cartoon of the sea surface temperature of the last 100 years. You see the temperature increasing up to 1940. I would like to convince you that that's real. You see this decrease between 40 and 75. That's also real. And then you see this reported increase, and I'd like to convince you that this is not real. This has been ascribed to human activities, of course, and I don't believe it's real. And the reason for this is the following. It is that while the solar visible radiation can penetrate into the ocean and deposit energy, infrared radiation cannot penetrate. It's absorbed in a thin skin in the uppermost layer of the ocean, way above where the measurements of ocean temperatures are taking place, which is usually down several meters into the ocean. The question is, how does this infrared radiation, how can it contribute to the measured sea surface temperature? It's a problem. It hasn't been tackled. This is a kind of cartoon I did. It shows the visible radiation penetrating into the ocean, and the infrared radiation, which comes from the greenhouse gases, only penetrating down into the skin, but not adding to the places where the temperatures are measured. We have no answer to this. This is a research problem that needs to be tackled. What we're trying to do currently is to define the problem and to define a measurement or experiment that could measure how much of the infrared radiation contributes to sea surface temperature. Is it 0%? Is it 100%? It can't be 100%. Or is it something in between? Probably something in between, but is it closer to 0 or is it closer to 100? If I were to guess, I would say it's closer to 0. If I were to guess, I would say that there's very little of this infrared radiation that contributes to the measured sea surface temperature. So we've devised an experiment, which has not yet been funded, but I will present it this week to the Department of Energy to see if we can set up an experiment to measure how much of the infrared radiation, how much of the greenhouse effect contributes to ocean temperatures. And here's the measurement. Here it is. It's essentially a float on the ocean measuring temperature up and down, above the ocean surface, below the ocean surface, and measuring the penetrating of the solar radiation, which is shortwave radiation. Oops. I'm learning how to use this. And then measuring the upwelling infrared from the ocean surface and the downwelling infrared from the greenhouse gases. That's never been done. That's what we want to measure. And then try to determine to what extent does the greenhouse effect work in the world's ocean. Now, quickly moving on, the next question is really, if the greenhouse effect does not work in the ocean, or doesn't work well, why do we see an increase in ocean temperature, as reported? Where does that come from? It's a puzzle. My view is that this is based on an artifact of the measurement. In other words, the measurements are wrong. Well, to try to explain this, I'll call your attention to the fact that to measure ocean temperatures, sea surface temperature, we use different methods. One of them is to measure temperatures from ships. That's the inlet temperature of the water that cools the engines and ships. And the other one is buoys, which are floating at the surface or near the surface, maybe 50 centimeters from the surface. But the buoys are close to the surface should measure a slightly higher temperature because that's where the solar radiation is absorbed. While the measurements down at the ship engine level are very deep, the sun doesn't penetrate to that level. I've tried to illustrate this here again. You see the buoys are about here, but close to the surface, to where the solar radiation is absorbed. But the inlet temperatures here, these measurements from ships, are maybe 10 meters down, depending on the size of the ship, of course, and should be slightly cooler. So there's a slight temperature increase, a temperature differential, with these temperatures being a little warmer. And now comes the important part, the fraction, okay, here it is. The fraction of measurements from buoys has been increasing. The percentage started at zero because in 1980 we had zero buoys, and now they've reached about 60%. So over the last 20, 25 years, the percentage of data points from buoys has increased from zero to about 60%, and these buoys show a slightly higher temperature, and therefore you measure a fictitious temperature trend, which really has to do with the fact that you're mixing buoys and ship data. If the SST temperature trend is artificial, and if the land stations are contaminated by urban heat island effects, then we have very little real warming after 1979, in the last 25 years. This would mean that the surface data would then agree with the satellite and balloon data. They would all show very little current warming, and therefore we believe that the greenhouse effect is a great deal smaller than what models predict. I have one final slide, a cartoon, which will give you our impression of what this is all about. This is the Wizard of Id. I can read it. This shows the reporter coming in to interview him about global warming and ask him, what are you going to do about it? And little King says, nothing. And if the Earth uses less fuel, then he says, less pollution means less global warming. And then the reporter says, you're saying the problem will take care of itself? And the answer is, what problem? Thank you. I have a few handouts. If those of you would like to have them, would approach me later, I would be glad to make them available.
You have about 8 minutes for questions.
Fred, your handout, which I read before your talk, is probably the best summary of global warming that I have yet to read, and I probably have 3 inches of stuff in my files on it, and this will come to the top. But even better than your summary is what Willie Soon did with Mercury in writing Mercury and Human Health, 10 Facts. And I think if you could go even beyond your paper and come up with, you know, a fact sheet of 10 facts that all of us could use in debating our friends and neighbors on this issue. I think the biggest problem of engaging people in discussing these issues with those in their arena, friends, something that I'm going to speak to this evening, is that we don't have enough simple information that we can all put our arms around and discuss different issues. So I would urge you to even take your marvelous paper and reduce it down very cleverly to 10 pieces of information, probably with peer-reviewed references for each one very briefly, because I know when I do this, people say, well, where is it published? Some people, and you got it. They'll never look up where it's published, but if you can quote something, you're ahead of the game. Yeah.
I think it's a good suggestion. We can keep the facts brief and use references on each one for those who would like to look up the publications. We'll try to work on that. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Singer. My name is Bob Briggs, and I'm curious about the reports that we keep hearing about massive glacier melting in Greenland, or occasionally it's tagged as in Antarctica. What about these reports? Is there anything to them at all?
I'm sorry, I really didn't quite get the question.
Are the glaciers melting, as the newspapers would tell you?
Oh, go on. Yeah, glaciers. This is a perennial issue. And I'm glad you raised it, because it's an issue that many people ask about. Let me first of all say that you don't measure temperatures using glaciers. You use thermometers. So that's always my first answer. Don't use glaciers. Use thermometers. Nevertheless, glaciers are melting, but not all of them. If you look at the IPCC report, not the summary, but the report itself, and look at page 128. I've quoted it so often, I remember the page number, and I can even remember the figure number. You'll find that of the 20 major glaciers in the world, they all started to shrink around 1850, when the climate started to warm. But since 1940, half of them have stopped shrinking, and many of those have started to advance again. What this shows is that each glacier is sui generis. It's a thing by itself. Glaciers either shrink or grow or advance, not just because of temperature, but also because of how much snow they get in the winter. You have to feed them. If you don't feed a glacier, it will disappear, no matter what the temperature is. So it's sensitive to many other factors than temperature. But the data indicate that this melting or shrinking of glaciers is not uniform, and those that are shrinking likely are not getting enough snow in the winter.
I give a lot of talks on this also, and there's a more striking phenomenon, and that is the Arctic areas are showing some melting, and the Antarctic is colder and is not melting, and there's probably 100 times as much ice and snow in the Antarctic as there is in the Arctic. So it's a question of scale, which is more important. My question is a friendly correction to your text of your handout. On page 3, you give an estimate of the future warming using the satellite data for a trend of 0.08 degrees centigrade for decade, and then when you go through the multiple lines of the calculation, your result says 0.6 C over the next or over the present value, but the multiplication that gives that is 0.65 times 9.5, so the equation isn't right. It just needs a typographical correction, I think.
There are several methods of estimating future temperatures from current data. One, as I try to show, is to simply extrapolate the satellite data. The satellite data have changed, incidentally, recently. The trend has gone up somewhat. So instead of 0.6, that method would now give one degree. Okay, that's still not serious, and still doesn't indicate that the warming is due to human activities. Because of what I show, the altitude dependence is just wrong. There are other methods for estimating the future temperature, and I'll mention one right now. Greenhouse gas concentrations have increased by about 50% since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. So a doubling would, and you ask, you know, what do we see from this? And even if we take the maximum of the 20th century, assuming that all of it is due to human activities, to greenhouse effects, additional warming would be another 0.6 degrees, so it gives you 1.2.